Welcome to the Bilge Pumps, where a bunch of naval geeks spout off.
Oh, good Lord, you're recording me again. Ooh. Why? Why? Ah, well,
yeah,
hello everyone.
I keep asking that question myself.
This is going to be a very interesting Bilge Pumps because it's infrastructure to an extent continued, but this time the regular crew is joined by, well, let's be honest,
Mr. Sal, infrastructure.
Sal practically could be regular crew. We have him on often enough. Pretty much every time we want to talk about a massive amount of infrastructure, we just go, Sal, are you free? And he goes, I'm skiing. I'm not free. And we go, when could you be free? And he goes, 5:30 a.m. on Monday morning. We go, fine. And poor Sal is sitting in front of us with about three coffees in front of him going, can I mainline this pub?
Now regretting his life choices.
Oh, that was a long time ago. I regretted my life choices. This is just confirmation of it at 5:30 in the morning after rolling in at 11 o'clock last night from a three-day ski weekend.
Oh, my! You're braver than I am.
Yeah, so good. So, we're talking about infrastructure. I'm happy about this. Hey, this is time number five for me. This is my fifth time on Bilge Pumps. I'm excited. No one's invited me back this many times.
Well, that's because we like it.
What's an ace in bilge? Does that make you a floater?
According to many.
So from the sounds of it, you know, Jamie's probably the only one who had a regular Sunday.
Because for those, well, it's been Monday. It's been Monday here.
Oh,
actually,
yes, of course.
So,
yeah.
But no, I've been having to reconstruct a reticent PC infrastructure problems. The last one was 7 years old and decided it didn't want to work properly anymore.
For those of you who are unaware, but this is being recorded on a Monday. It's various flavors of Monday because obviously for Sal it's ungodly hour of the morning. For me and Dr. Clark, it's somewhat reasonable hours of the morning. And for Jamie, Monday's almost over already. So Jamie's been rebuilding his PC. Dr. Clark was playing whack-a-mole with felt roof tiles because we've just
I was
had,
on top of the shed.
Because we've just had storms. I played out.
At least I know the roof now supports my weight.
Sal's obviously been skiing. I spent most of Storm Eunice running around a field in Kent being shot at. Because I was having a full day of airsoft, which was great fun until someone fell over and broke my SA-80, which I suppose is, you know, in keeping with its reputation.
Yes, seriously. Here's what you do in actual combat if you have an SA-80. You use it to club someone who has a decent gun and take that off them.
At which point I grabbed dual scorpions and just ran in and started hosing everybody at 10 yards, which was about the only range you could guarantee to hit anything in 60-mile-an-hour gusts.
You supply alcohol to the Americans and they while they're drinking, they forget their guns and you take them off them, which is the non-lethal way of getting a gun.
Well, you know, tried and tested way. I mean, that's how the Royal Navy got its extended range shield tanks in the Pacific Theatre for a case of scotch.
Yes.
Hey, we're easy. I mean, again, we're pliable.
This is, you know, people don't realise it's the most important diplomatic space on the Queen Elizabeth and Prince of Wales, the pub.
Yes, we know.
I actually didn't think you guys were going to get those Marines off there. Can I be clear? I was pretty sure that they were going to convert and just change nationality and stay on there.
To be fair, after meeting the Queen, they were several of them went from being very, you know, liking the Republican orientated, etc. You know, we like a republic, to show me to the Queen's enemies, I will kill them in about 2 seconds after meeting her.
Every report that's been written by anybody from VMFA 212, I'm telling you right now, under the surface of that, they talk about the great deployment on board the ship. Is underlying that is they had beer on board. That's underlying the entire...
They had beer and they had a queen we liked.
It's not stated, but I'm telling you, that is the whole purpose of them wanting. Now they're going to fight. They can literally, you realize you can get a steel cage match between Marine squadrons now to deploy on Prince of Wales when she goes. So,
yeah,
I mean,
they're guaranteed to have the crack squadron from the US Marine Corps. It's going to be the ones who survive the cage fights. it's good.
So, but okay. So, the takeaway message from the story so far is that if you want decent infrastructure supported by decent crew, supply beer.
Yes.
How's that worked out on your construction sites, Drac?
To be fair, I don't think most people notice the quality difference these days. construction sites are just a nightmare. We'll put it this way. In Croydon, my previous employment, there was a 22-story block of flats that was basically the first high-rise that was started as part of the big redevelopment that I was overseeing. About a year after they started, another company about 50, 60 yards away started a 42-story pair of blocks, each of which was considerably also larger in footprint. 2 years later, the 42-story pair were finished. The 22-story pair, last I drove through Croydon last week, still hasn't completed 4 years after they started. So, yeah.
Me thinking they're never going to finish.
They might do. I mean, they've been working on the external cladding and rendering for about 8 months. So at some point, they're going to run out of panels to fit.
Like it will get blown away.
Well, that, so, yeah.
So the next up, of course, is broadly speaking infrastructure.
Mm.
And we're talking about the three types of infrastructure which navies depend upon. There's the ports, shipyards, and those sort of facilities. There is the maritime infrastructure, as in your own merchant marine, which are things you tend to call up in wartime when you need them to move your stuff, because, believe it or not, very rarely do governments supply enough in peacetime to move all the equipment and things you need to move in wartime, let alone the food supplies and other things you might need to put to deliver to allies. And three, your auxiliary forces, because, and this is where it starts, and I have to give a big shout out to Engaging Strategy. If you don't follow them on Twitter, you're missing out. They produced their almost annual chart on auxiliary strength in terms of Europe and all the European nations to put sort of combine and what they're doing. And it scared the bejesus out of us because, once again, the Royal Fleet Auxiliary is larger than the rest of Europe combined. That is it. The British Royal Fleet Auxiliary. Let's be honest, the ones who regularly I have to, with politicians, explain who exactly they are and why they should fund them. And not as low a level of politicians as we would like to be. Regularly, I have to explain what they do and what they are, and yet they still have managed to be more successful at getting funding than the rest of Europe combined.
Is that just geopolitics? I mean, why would a German vessel need resupply when it's operating in the Baltic?
Well, they want to stay out of the Baltic for longer than a single tank of fuel.
Yeah.
But where can you go that doesn't require more than a single tank of fuel?
Well, so you want to stay out there for more than a month.
I can see your point.
I can agree,
but the trouble is the rest of Europe also includes France, Spain, Portugal, Italy.
I put it in the same category.
Well, to be fair, Italy does like to operate slightly further afield, as does France, and Norway, etc.
France is pretty much the only one, really, that, you know, is in a similar boat to you, I suppose, isn't it? They've got the widely flung vestiges of empire floating around. I don't know whether Spain's got much left rattling around in its empire basket.
Well, the main problem, I think, is that if you don't have some kind of replenishment system going, it means that anyone who wants to do something that you could deter with a naval presence basically can mathematically work out how much they need to get rid of you, which is either, let's say you can keep a sustained force out there by cycling ships from your home ports. So given that most of these navies are fairly small, it's sort of like, well, if you can, say, sustain a destroyer and a frigate on station indefinitely by cycling them, then all your enemy needs to do is show up with something that's more powerful than a destroyer and a frigate. If you want to show up with a stronger force that you can't sustain by cycling, then the enemy just has to go, okay, well, how long is their fuel going to last? We'll go in a week after that. And we're golden.
And On the subject of the French Navy, they currently have two 17,900-ton Durant-class vessels in service as their fleet oilers. They are replacing them with four, but currently these four vessels which they are supposed to be replacing them, which are going to be slightly bigger in terms of their thing, they're going to be 31,000 tons fully loaded. One is due for delivery in 2023 and was laid down in 2021. The second is due for delivery in 2025 and steel was cut in 2022. The third is due in delivery in 2027 and the fourth in 2029. So about, I'd reckon, two governments away. So what are the odds that during that time someone decides, you know what, we've got two, we always had two, we were fine with two, we don't need more than two?
Yeah, possibly. I mean, it's a similar problem with the frigates, I suppose, isn't it? You know, what do you need that many frigates for?
Well, I mean, they went from going with PA2, their proposed second aircraft carrier, to not having that, to then saying, actually, we are going to have an aircraft carrier of about that size, but it's going to be a replacement for Charles de Gaulle, which is why I don't take any of the images or proposals for that seriously at all, because they're proposing delivery sometime in the 2030s. And if you think a project that's envisaged at the beginning of the 2020s is going to resemble anything close to that by the 2030s.
Back to logistics. I mean, the other option is, of course, is just to hitch a ride with the Yanks.
Assuming that your foreign policy aligns with the Americans, which French foreign policy and American foreign policy have very rarely ever been on the same track.
And looking at Sal's face with that, there's also the problem is that do the Americans have enough to support themselves, let alone support anyone else hitching their way along? That they can, I can sort of see, because the British do, whilst I don't think the RFA is big enough, the British have enough of an RFA that maybe hitching with the Yanks is possible because the Americans don't have to do too much. And the RFA can also do their burden sharing. But can they really afford to be the entire auxiliary, not only for their own forces, but for their allies as well?
Well, I think you get a couple of things. Number one, I think one of the other reasons that you don't build auxiliary, some nations don't, is they don't want to support their navies being forward deployed. I mean, it takes that element right away. I mean, you can't keep it forward sustained. You maintain it at home. If you don't have the underway replenishment, then you're dependent on shore bases. And if you don't have the shore bases to sustain it, you can't do it. So, you know, if you're the Portuguese, you really want to get involved in a long protracted deployment somewhere. And you can sit there and say, well, we can't because we haven't invested in an underway replenishment vessel or enough facilities to get our bases, because, you know, the Portuguese are loved everywhere around the world. Mm-hmm. So, you know, they just can't do it. I think on the American side, again, we just had our chief of naval operations give a talk at a big conference on the West Coast, where he's talking about the right size of the U.S. Navy is 500 vessels with 100 support vessels. I don't know what he's thinking, where he's going to get this money from to build this. We can't even get the 300 vessels, and he's talking about 500. And what's amazing to me is the Kool-Aid that everybody else drinks and sits there and goes, "You're right, CNO. You're exactly right."
Before you even get the money, where are you actually going to build the things in the first place?
Let's not even talk about that
yet. Build the yards before you can build the ships. You need to build the yards.
I mean, all you got to do is take a look at, you know, our auxiliaries coming in and they rode hard, put away wet. I mean, they are you know, run ragged all the time. You know, the first Kaiser class came out in the 80s. And yeah, they're great. I mean, I always say that U.S. replenishment ships are kind of the, you know, they're the ultimate. I mean, they are. I mean, if one, the U.S. Navy has something going for it, it's their replenishment ships. They're big. They can do everything. They're fantastic, but they're limited in number and they're spread so thin. You know, right now running around the Mediterranean, you've got one, you know, large replenishment vessel, which is great, but it's one vessel, you know, and it's got to sustain a carrier battle group and everybody else tagged along with it. You have to pull other replenishment ships in to do it. And the other problem we have, I'll tell you right now, is we are short-term replenishment. We need a forward base to operate from. If all of a sudden you have to do transatlantic, trans-Pacific, they're in a lot of trouble because they don't have the vessels to do it. I mean, they just don't. You know, where is it? Who's going to haul that fuel? I mean, everyone forgets. They love to look at World War II and they look at the great Pacific carrier drive, Task Force 38 and Task Force 58. you know, and they talk about these, you know, dozens of underway replenishment vessels, Service Squadron 10. It's great. Nobody looks at the hundreds of vessels that had to sustain those vessels that were bringing fuel from California, from Texas, all the way across. And that's the big...
It's one of the things I have to get into, because the amount of people who look at the Royal Navy in that period go, well, the Royal Navy's only got a small number of fast fleet oilers and they aren't building as many. Well, that's because the Royal Navy's working on actually getting oil between its bases, and for the oil being moved around between bases, you don't need a fast fleet oiler. You need something that's going to move bulk efficiently. So that's what they were building. And yes, it's not sexy. Yes, it's not going to make any headlines, but they matter. But I'm fast coming to the opinion that if I wanted to cripple the American Navy or any Navy in power projection terms, I wouldn't bother targeting the carrier. It's going to be well defended and in the center of the task force. I wouldn't even bother the destroyers. I'd take out the auxiliaries. They're far fewer in number, far more difficult to replace. And once they're gone, the rest of the fleet will soon run out of fuel and have to go home.
It's always been that way, hasn't it?
Yes.
I mean, was, you know, going after the supply ships for the raiders?
Yeah, but in previous times, there were so many supply ships out there, it would take an awful lot of time and you could concentrate them in convoys. Whereas these days, I think apart from the US support fleet, pretty much almost everybody else's support fleet is small enough that, if it even exists at all, that one decent spread of torpedoes from a decent sized sub could probably put pay to all of them for any given Navy.
I mean, you know, just going back to what I was saying before, you know, you think of in terms of the huge force that the United States had to support Task Force 3858. That was only enough to support Task Force 3858. The Royal Navy had to develop and scratch together from its Sir Rickety fleet its own fleet train. And that fleet train had to traverse from Britain across the Indian Ocean into, through the South China Sea and up to, the Senkaku Islands, Okinawa. Mm. And that was because that massive support fleet was just enough to support those carriers, those battleships, those cruisers, and those destroyer pickets that were operating for the US by the US.
People often ask why the American battle fleet stays at home so often. They don't deploy their battleships. Mm-hmm. It's because they need their huge oil hogs.
At the beginning of the war. You've also got to take into account that all of that was possible with forward bases like Ulithi. So a lot of your slower support ships could just cycle back and forth there relatively peacefully. Yes. And then the tip of the spear, the replenishment ships just had to operate over that short distance from places like that to the main fleet. Whereas these days, I have a distinct feeling that if you're ending up in a conflict where you actually need your support fleet, the people you're fighting are probably not going to be as kind as to let you establish a major forward replenishment station a few hundred miles behind the front lines.
Yeah. Oh, I agree. One of the things I just did is I just gave a paper at the Navy Expeditionary Warfare Conference. And you know, they wanted me to do a talk on late war logistics. I said, no. I said, if you want the analogy of today, it's early war naval logistics. And, you know, I talked about the fact that, you know, it operates six fast fleet carriers, you know, the Enterprise, Saratoga, all the very first fleet carriers. Mm-hmm. You had six fast oilers. I mean, that was it. There were 12 fast oilers converted by the U.S. Navy at the beginning of World War II. These were ships that were commercially built under a subsidy program under the Merchant Marine Act of 1936. They were given national defense features. They were twin screw, vice one screw. They were 18 knots, vice 14 knots, extra capacity. Provisions for communications, for guns, for extra crew on board. And as the Navy needed them, they took them over. And you know, you saw Neosho sitting there at Pearl Harbor. They were absolutely vital. And they were
beautiful ships. I mean, there's a fantastic photo of a USS Robin sitting alongside of one of them.
Yep. I would argue that the argument is the six carriers held the line in 1942 into 43, and I would argue, well, it's the six oilers that did it.
Held the carriers,
because there was a study done just before the Coral Sea battle where they were deploying two task forces, Yorktown and Lexington down there. Enterprise and Hornet was on the way from the Doolittle raid. And they came up with the study about, okay, this is the amount of oilers we're going to need. We're going to need five Neosho class oilers. We're going to need three smaller oilers. And then we're going to need at least three commercial vessels coming every month to be able to sustain these carriers in the Coral Sea to maintain that lifeline between the United States and Australia. And I would argue, you know, the loss of Lexington and then the loss of Neosho was critical at that time. And because you did, I mean, all of a sudden now you lost one of those fast oilers. And even at the beginning of the Guadalcanal campaign, when you only had five of these left, three of them were with the Task Force 61 for the attack on Guadalcanal. The other two were on the West Coast because they had a fast shuttle fuel from San Pedro across. And again, you didn't have the other six because four of them were taken in hand to be converted into escort carriers, basically mini fleet carrier replacements until Independence and Essex class came online. And logistics was the whole thing. Read through Nimitz's gray book. Yeah. You look through the sink pack. I mean, all they're talking about. As a matter of fact, there was one moment there in January of 1942 where they get 20 commercial tankers allocated to pack fleet to support the six Neosho class. And then in March, they want more, but they can't get them because German U-boats are sticking them off the East Coast. So, I mean, it's all the ability to sustain your fleet. And you're right about Task Force One, the battleships. They could never get the battleships off the West Coast because they just consume too much fuel.
And two things. One, it's just got really serious because Jamie's put his glasses on. But also, I should point out there are assassins moving behind him because I keep seeing heads peering out from corners and looking at him. And I'm reckoning we're going to see a Jamie shot in a second.
She's annoyed. She's annoyed that I just turned off her Minecraft.
For those who are about to be in pain, we salute you. But also, the other thing I'm going to add is we spend our whole time these days talking about task force strengths, etc., and all these things. And we look at them, we talk about carrier battle groups. How often do we hear the escort discussion go, well, right then, we're going to need to be escorting the fleet auxiliaries backwards and forwards. So have we got a spare escort to do that? Because you're going to need an escort to do it. And in fact, when I look at the Canadian surface combatant and I look at the Australian hunter class and their sort of more general purpose escort frigates in a way route, I sit there and go, well, those are really sort of the perfect ships for that because this isn't going to be heading into the this is going to be heading out of the high threat zone, hopefully. So it probably won't need a massive amount of long range air defense, but it's going to need something to protect it against air attack, to protect it against missile attack and submarines. But the thing is, you sit there and go, okay, well, that's good. But the nice way the Canadians and the Australians are building them to do their own operations. They're not building them to go and escort the American auxiliary fleet or the British auxiliary fleet. And you sit there and look at the Americans and Brits and go, so what is going to be escorting your auxiliaries when they're having to leave the combat zone? And please note, if you say LCS, we will not only laugh, we will give your auxiliary men employment and citizenship for a different nation.
I mean, you could tie the LCS to the side of them and use them as a plate of armor.
You're gonna if you bring them with you, you're gonna be refueling them the entire time. You realize that, yes. Right? I mean, they're literally gonna be hooked up. They are gonna be hooked up to the side of you because you have to have a fuel hose in them.
Basically, an LCS to go with them is going to have to be on an umbilical cord the entire way.
But this is the point, isn't it? The LCS is massively inefficient at your sort of standard fleet operating speeds. It's designed to either creep or to go flat out in terms of its gearings. Is that not right?
It's going to be doing 40 knots around you. I mean, it's going to be circling around you the whole time. I mean, you know, in Defender 2020, the new commander of Transportation Command had this, you know, kind of intro brief she did with CSIS. And she talked about Defender 2020, where they escorted ships across the Atlantic. There were two ships they escorted across from Beaumont, Texas, over to Europe. And they had to get a Ticonderoga class cruiser. The Vela Gulf had to do it. And the only reason she did it, it's because she was the only one that had the range to do it. I mean, there was no other ships that could steam 10,000 or whatever. That was about 7,000 miles, I think it was. She had steam. Burks couldn't do it. Nobody could do it. No one could go across that route that she was going to go without having an oiler strapped to it. And they didn't have an oiler. So they had to, you know, commit a Ticonderoga class cruiser. How often is that going to happen in a conflict where you're going to get one of the few remaining working Ticonderoga class cruisers to go escort, you know, merchant ships across.
There is, it's another point, this is another point though, where we get to the Zumwalt class, which was stopped after three ships, actually could do that as well. And this is the other point. You keep, every time I keep going back to the Zumwalt class, this just shows me the problem for the US Navy. The LCS they've kept building because of the contracts, even though they know it's problematic and it's not working, really they needed to stop it and restart the program if they were going to try and continue with it after they'd worked through the problems. The Zumwalt class, they stopped after three because the fancy bits which were supposed to be attached on the top didn't work, and they didn't want to go back to the standard bits because that'd be less cool and less sexy, because this is a Rumsfeld era, you know, design, so it has to be everything all single bouncing. But the base of it was actually really good, and if you kept those hulls coming out, you could have fitted them up with SP, the SPY off the Burks, you could give them Mark 41 VLS, and you'd have had a wonderful ship to just wander around doing the jobs you need until you could actually work out something better. It's got a massive hole. You can do the stuff with it.
But that's the point, though. Sal, how hard is a Zumwalt hull to build?
How hard?
Does it need specific sorts of shipyards? Are there limited numbers that can handle that type of hull?
Well, there's only one right now. I mean, Bath was the only one that was building it right now. But again, yeah, you know, you can get another yard to do it, but then you have to gear it up. But Bath was ecstatic about stop building them because they want to go back to Burks. They want to go back to pumping out something that they can do. It required them to retool the yard. They had planned that contract to be 32 vessels. So they geared them up for a 32 vessel run. And instead they wound up with three. And even if you go the model of the Seawolves, which were three, and then you get the Virginias, there's still no follow on. You know, what's the follow on to Zumwalt?
Well, you're committing the rest of your submarine construction for the next decade for Australia, aren't you?
Well, that's exactly right. I mean, we don't say anything about that, but of course, that's exactly what we're going to do. We're digging some old sturgeons out. We're going to give you for a while, and they're still laid up in Bremerton, so we'll dust them off and send them your way.
To be fair, though, on good news on that one, the British submarine construction thing has said actually they might have even more slips than we thought they had, because we thought they had seven slips, and it turns out they might actually have eight in the reconfigured yard when they're building it. So we actually have more slips than we need, and we are still not upping our construction numbers, so we have gaps. So I have an idea of where, in nicest way, well, the Americans no gaps, so I have a feeling that Australians are probably going to have to end up going.
I mean, America, you know, we know America. If they can buy two for the price of three, they will. So I'm sure that they've got a spare slip somewhere as well.
No. I'm not sure about that anymore now. I mean, we've only got 2 yards building subs. So,
only got one. It's just working at about 30% capacity.
And let me be clear, everything is going to take second place to Columbia being built and the new ballistic missile submarines. The Navy is so adamant about that. That is number one on the Navy's priority right now. I think it's even going to bump forward in some ways. They want those new boomers built as soon as possible to replace the Ohios. And any slip in that is going to cause problems. So I just don't know where they get the capacity.
We're lucky with the Brits. We're only building four dreadnoughts.
Is the solution here to start building nuclear powered support vessels again? Since you don't have the oilers to back them up, should we start seeing some of the nice big nuclear powered cruisers rolling off the stocks?
Ooh.
Well, I mean, we're talking about building what they call the next generation logistics ship, which is basically a kind of a European size support vessel, because they can't keep building the big ones, like the John Lewis class or the Lewis and Clark class. So they're looking at this, what they call next generation logistics ship, which is going to get them more logistics platforms out there, which are designed to, you know, sustain smaller vessels, auxiliary merchant vessels type kind of construction. But again, it's all notional. I don't understand why they just wouldn't go out and grab themselves a pre-designed, you know, nice size replenishment vessel. There are great size replenishment vessels out there. And if you look at the European, go back to what Alex was talking about at the very beginning, I mean,
One of the things that we've seen, the Germans have done this, is study. Sebastian Bruns, who's now at the Navy Academy, did a great study a few years ago on a European auxiliary force. You know, to pool together resources together to run a joint logistics force that can sustain multiple navies. Of course, the issue you come into is what Drac talked about, is the politics of it. You know, does the politics match? You know, are you going to be able to get a Danish vessel to support a French operation that maybe they don't politically support, but under a naval sharing agreement, they have to provide the ship? And that's always been the brunt that they have to saddle with. Because again, logistics ships are not sexy, but they're the ones that get you out there and keep you sustained. Look at what the Chinese are doing. The Chinese are clandestinely, but very, very quickly developing a robust auxiliary force that's not just planned Navy, it's also their merchant vessels. They have the ability to convert their tankers over to replenishment vessels, and they demonstrate that on a pretty consistent basis.
Well, you see, it's the thing is, I'm looking at the Royal Fleet Auxiliary as we speak. I'm sort of looking at their, I've got their list up on me, up I am. And the thing is, I was talking about the French ones, and of course, they're building four newer ships. Not a single one of even their newer ships are going to come anywhere close, i.e. within 10,000 tons of any of the Royal Navy's Tide class oilers. And the Royal Navy has four of those. And the Royal Navy doesn't really think it has enough. It has what the government's allowed it, but it doesn't think it has enough. Now, yes, the Royal Navy's planning on trying to support at least one, if not two, carrier battle groups. But you sit there and you start to look at these things and you're going, we need more. And also, I would have said in the nicest way, if I was talking to the Americans, I'd have gone, have you seen the Tide class? They're fairly decent. If you want an off-the-shelf oiler, just go buy it. You can buy the bigger Evolution because it's one of those. If you've seen a Tide class design, it was produced. The designers who produced it have produced what's called a modular, evolvable design. So it's kind of like Volvo, where they all look the same. They're just slightly bigger in terms of from the smallest to the largest in the Volvo designs. And it's the same with the Tide class oilers. If you look at them, there are various other classes of them which are slightly smaller, slightly larger. And, you know, what they can produce. Actually, I think the Tide class are sort of the biggest ones but at the moment. But they do have a bigger design. And they are a fast fleet tanker. And it's off the shelf. The Royal Norwegian Navy has one, HMS Maud, which is the slightly smaller variant. And you just go, okay, it's off the shelf. You've bought the, you're getting the Constitution class, which are as off the shelf as the US Navy ever gets. Surely you could do the same with a tanker instead of going through eons and eons of development.
Still going to take us 10 years to come up with the Constellation class because we have to monkey with everything. So we just yeah. can't take anything off the shelf. I mean, you're right. I mean, Daewoo would sell you that design in a second. I guarantee you that Daewoo would. I mean, there's no question about that.
Daewoo are this wonderful company. They have no. If you're prepared to give them money, they will take it.
Well, and you've also got to factor in that, you know, of all the various arms of a navy, the infrastructure, the support ships are probably the one area where you can actually afford to either take things up as designed without much change or even from trade if your national fleet has the relevant ships there, because they are the supply ships, they're the behind the lines vessels. They're not supposed to get shot at. And if they do get shot at, to be honest, it probably doesn't matter too much what standard you've built them to, because if you've loaded 20,000 tons of fuel oil and you eat an Exocet or a Silkworm amidships, you're going to be on fire regardless of what you put in them.
I have to say, I do love it. The Tide class, of course, are fitted with two Phalanx closing weapon systems and two 30mm cannons. And I'm honestly sitting there looking at it and going, That's just not fair. Okay, at least we have the Thought class, which we have one left of, which were originally fitted for, but not with Seawolf. At least that was something. You know, fit these four, not with Sea Scepter. Give them some hope.
They'll keep small craft away if somebody just decides to send a motorboat after them or something.
So, Sal, is there momentum building to replace those poor, rusty replenishment ships?
In the U.S. Navy, I mean, we just launched John Lewis, which is the newest class of oiler, which is bigger than it's bigger than the Henry J. Kaiser class, which is ironic because it carries a little bit less fuel than the Kaiser does. It has a very unique design. The smokestack is really amazing design. It's the ugliest thing I've ever seen. It's a horrendous looking thing that's going to be changed. It's going to be changed already because they've gotten every time I talk to anybody from NASCO, that's the one thing they hear all
this,
the time.
Like, is it bigger and heavier because of the whole, you know, multiple hull requirements for tanking vessels?
It's a double hull design, which is required. So they had to get the double hull design in it. It also has some ability to replenish dry goods and food. So it's a little bit of a combination, but not a lot, which is what really surprised me about this design. I would argue that the John Lewis design, which is a fine design, I mean, it's good, but it really wasn't evolutionary. It was almost just a repeat. It really didn't change anything. I was really surprised they didn't build themselves a smaller all-around replenishment vessel instead of just a straight oiler, which is what she's listed as. I mean, oiler is supposedly just fuel. And whereas the store ships are food and ammunition, you know, they're completely separate. So, you know, if you deploy a battle group or whatever task force you want, you either need one of the two AOEs, the fast support logistic ships, the Arctic or the Supply, or you need one of each of the Kaiser and then the Lewis and Clark class with you. And they really weren't very revolutionary, these vessels. I would argue that they basically follow the same design. But I think it goes back to a question I had yesterday. You know, Walker Mills from SimSec posted something on Twitter, which I got me going before I took off on my trip.
It was a nice 17 long, or
it was
18.
Long. It was a lot.
18 tweets.
I was trying to pack it, and then like Walker set this off, and then Phil Weir jumped into it, and then Claude Bearbay, and it was like, oh, you guys are killing me. It's like I gotta pack it, like, but I had to answer this first. And you know, he had a very simple tweet, and I got up here from Walker. It's like, the Navy's primary purpose is to sustain friendly commerce by sea, and it's in quotes. And he basically makes this argument: is that still valid? Is that still a valid point? Is the primary purpose of a Navy to protect shipping, you know, commerce at sea? And I would make the argument that not only is that still true, but I think the U.S. Navy has lost that ability entirely. It doesn't see it as a mission and doesn't realize how successful it's the most successful mission, I would argue, that the U.S. Navy and every other Navy in the world that support it, because it's not just the U.S. Navy that did this. Let's be clear. Stop taking credit for, you know, maintaining the seas post-World War II. It was a joint effort by multiple nations, but it's one of the greatest efforts ever. I mean, it's what spurred global commerce to the point that we can freely move goods everywhere. We don't have to worry about it anymore. And
you consider the number of freedom of the seas and freedom of navigation jobs we all have to keep, navies keep having to do in the last 10 years, they've suddenly gone from being something which happened occasionally to being something which almost every other month you're hearing about a Navy having to be used to do a freedom of navigation pass through somewhere to go, no, we can go through here.
But
Jamie's getting lined up on again.
I think it's
forgotten.
Well, it's forgotten. I think it's this bifurcation of military and commercial shipping. I mean, the navies don't see commercial being relevant at all. They just completely detach themselves from it. They see it as a separate entity, and they don't understand how important they are. I go back to the issue that, you know, does the U.S. need a merchant marine? It's like, well, no, not to carry its goods. It doesn't. I said, but you know what it does for you? It provides you shipyards. It provides you repair facilities. It provides you all that infrastructure you need so that skills. When you finally build a ship, it's not a one-of-a-kind vessel that we have to figure out how to build it. Because we're already, I mean, again, I go back to China and you look at, you know, the CSC yards and you can see, you know, 003 being built in the slipway right next to ultra large container vessels. They've learned how to build vessels multiple different ways. And they are maximizing their ability. I mean, they've embraced and sucked down my hand in a jar that's bigger than my coffee cup this morning.
Well, I mean, graving docks and dry docks and slipways are true neutral when it comes to what they can build. They're limited just by their size and whether you're, as you said, whether you're building an ultra large container ship or an aircraft carrier, the cranes, etc., all of that is all the same. It's just the only difference is how much security acts, how much security clearance are you giving the people who are putting the parts together?
I had an executive at one of the largest shipyards in America tell me that they did a war game with the Pentagon where the argument they got from the Pentagon was, you know, why we don't need repair facilities and everything. It's like, well, whatever war we fight in the future is going to be quick and fast. It's going to be over. And the ships, listen, they said this, the ships that are damaged, we'll just pull aside and we're going to fight with what we have. There's not going to be time to repair anything or build anything new. So we're going to have to fight with what we have. And I'm just sitting there going, oh my God, this is like every lesson of war ever in history. It's like, oh, it'll be over by Christmas. You know, they never tell you what Christmas.
Every single naval campaign that's happened with a Navy that's made that assumption has ended up with that Navy losing to the side that had infrastructure to back up their repairs.
Or alternatively, has ended up with the Royal Navy having to do a crash build and have to have an argument with Winston Churchill about whether or not they should actually keep building stuff.
But he cancels it all every single time. But that comes back to Sal's point about even having the infrastructure to actually do that in the first place.
Yes.
Because you're going in with a thought of, oh, well, this war might be over in 6 months or whatever, is all well and good, but you know that's not the ideal to go in with in the first place. But if you are going to go in with it, the only way you're going to pull yourself out of it is if you have the capability to either then, once you come to your senses, build ships, which means you have to have the infrastructure, or I suppose in the absolute worst case, have the, even if you step back even further, have the national infrastructure to allow you to rapidly build the infrastructure. It's almost the tools to build the tools. I'm thinking actually of things like, you know, the Kaiser shipyards in World War II, where they're like, well, we want to build escort carriers, but we don't have the dockyards to build escort carriers. Well, we'll build a new dockyard and then we'll build the escort carriers in that dockyard. But then that requires you to have the kind of massive construction, quick construction capability that was present in World War II, as opposed to, well, we'd like to build some emergency dockyards. Well, here's a cost analysis and environmental impact proposal, and here's our special interest focus group research, and we're going to need at least $40 million and a year to complete that, at which point we can start the consultation on the bidding process for whoever's actually going to, oh, and the Chinese have taken over San Francisco.
it sounds like AUKUS.
Yeah. I mean, and sort of going back slightly to Sal's earlier point about, you know, protecting commerce at sea, look at the successful navies. I mean, this is shades of both Mahan and Corbett. Look back at the successful navies over the past 500 years and when they fell. Yeah? So the Spanish, they kept control over the Atlantic and the Pacific, and their decline can pretty much be traced to the point when French and British and or English at the time and Dutch ships started to get into the Pacific, which the Spanish had assumed they didn't need to protect because no one else could get there. And then they failed to protect. And then in the Atlantic, you had the pretty much those same three nations showing up and taking chunks out of the Spanish merchant fleet. And for a while they held on because they started escorting convoys with their big galleons. But as those other navies grew in strength and the Spanish didn't really grow their navy to match, they ended up losing the top spot because they could no longer protect their commerce and the other nations could shut down their commerce or at least severely interdict it. And then you had the Dutch who popped up with a massive merchant fleet, and using that, they built, same as Spain, they built massive amounts of wealth based off of trade. And it wasn't just their merchant fleet, everyone else wanted to trade with the Dutch as well. But although they fought three Anglo-Dutch, well, they fought more than three Anglo-Dutch wars, but they fought three Anglo-Dutch wars where it was just Britain versus the Netherlands. Although they did pretty well in the naval conflict side of it for most of it, every time they had one of those wars, the key difference was that the British kept taking massive chunks out of their merchant fleet. And that meant that as the wars went on, the Dutch Republic got successively less and less able to have the money and the commerce and the, you know, the wealth to maintain the war fleet. And then it would kind of a vicious cycle. If you don't protect your merchant shipping, you don't have the money to make a war fleet, and your war fleet therefore loses, so you can't protect the merchant shipping, so you have even less money, and so on and so forth. And then you get the Royal Navy taking over that position all through the late 18th and then into the entirety of the 19th century. Yes, the British had the biggest merchant marine on the planet, but lots of other nations were also trading with Britain. And Britain kept its wealth. I mean, that was pretty much the key to the whole Napoleonic Wars period, was, you know, Britain could shut down France's overseas commerce and it could trade freely with the rest of the world. And it was the same in World War One. There was
obviously World War Two.
Yeah, but there was the Western Front and the land campaigns going on there. But Germany ultimately was being ground down economically by the fact that the Royal Navy had a blockade going. Germany couldn't trade with the outside world. And as long as they could deal with the U-boats, Britain could. And World War II was slightly less of a threat from the U-boats than it got to in 1917. And Germany kind of was a bit better able to keep going because it did actually have control of most of Europe, as opposed to World War One when they didn't. But they were still economically on the down, sort of grinding down as the war went on. So it's a common maxim of, you know, ever since there's been a nation in the last cycle of history, if you like, because you've got the Romans in the intervening period thereafter. But since then, whatever nation is going to be dominant has been the nation that can secure access to world trade. It doesn't need to be their own trade, but as long as they can access world trade and they can deny that access to the enemy, then in any kind of protracted conflict, you're going to win because you just have access to far more materials and far more wealth than the other side does. And eventually they'll run out and you won't.
The same can be said for Venice in the Italian city-states, and basically Venice's days are numbered when the Portuguese make it to the Indian Ocean. That's when the Venetian Empire starts to crumble, because the Portuguese start to take away the trade which had been going through Venice and going through the Levant and up to Venice. You know, this is the one key point about history, and it's one of those things, whenever I say it, people almost react to me as if I'm a naval boo. You know, not a T-boo or a Wear-boo or all those things we often sort of, but it's, oh, you're just saying that because you like navies. It's like when we talk about Russia, and I go, well, one of Russia's constant strategic aims has always been to secure access to ports which are open all year round and safe. Yeah. People go, oh, you just say that because you're just obsessed with navies. And I go, no, it's one of the constant themes of Russia's entire history has been to try and get control of these ports. By the way, usually once they go through Ukraine, the next place they head for is the Dardanelles and Istanbul or Constantinople or whatever you want to call it at the time. But the thing is, it's the constant through history is the nations which are able to access global trade, who are able to be part of global trade, do well. And if you want to win a war, you cut off your opponent's access to global trade, or you interfere it. And this is another problem, I think, when it comes to the infrastructure thing. If you don't have a strong enough fleet auxiliary to support your navy, and you don't have a strong enough navy to protect your fleet auxiliary, and to protect your merchant marine when they're doing their convoys, you're going to then have your merchant marine being whittled down by the fact you don't have much to begin with, because it's usually foreign flag. So Panama has masses, but, you know, America and Britain has a lot less. Then you have the joy of the fact that you don't have the ships to protect it, and you're also needing those ships to come and try to take over the roles which should be being done by your fleet auxiliary, because you don't have the fleet auxiliary to do it. So you are in more of a trouble. And then we get onto the fact that, and this was the point which Sal produced yesterday in his tweet thread, in his responsible discussions, insurance. And the fact that if you're talking about these massive container ships that can be carrying billions of pounds worth of goods on one ship, that if the insurance estimates go up too high that you can't get insurance for them to go to sea, they're going to be stuck in port.
And that's what happens. And that's what you saw at the beginning of World War One. If you look at, there was a study done on shipping in World War One, and one of the things they looked at specifically was insurance. And they said, you know, even in the first months when the German cruisers were out there, and even though they didn't sink that many vessels at all, it was the threat. All it took was the threat to create a quick spike in insurance. And that didn't last long because the Royal Navy was able to hunt down the cruisers pretty quickly and secure the sea. But again, when the
whole Battle of Falklands was about literally the Royal Navy going, we control the sea. Yep. And we're doing it emphatically because we just lost Coronel. We need to show the world we're doing it emphatically. So instead of sending cruisers, which was all we really need to do the job, we're sending battle cruisers down as fast. And they could, well, there was one point, I think, when they were considering sending more than two battle cruisers, it would have been three or even four to go and make sure that everyone really knew how powerful the Royal Navy was. And arguably, it's that experience which is what leads to Jackie Fisher getting justification for renown and repulse, but also for the admiral class, because that's what they're being built for, control of the sea.
But that goes to that fun. And again, I'm not picking on Walker here. I think Walker's tweet was great because it started this whole concept here. But I think Walker misses the concept of the U.S. Navy is designed for power projection. It's purely a power projection. It's forward deployed power projection Navy. Yet if you look at the Chinese Navy, it's not. It's not a power projection Navy at all. Matter of fact, it's a pure Bahamian style Navy that's designed to protect its trade. They're on the 40th escort group in Somalia. You know, why are the Chinese deploying a support group to Somalia? Why do they have one base in Djibouti? Why are they talking about creating a second base on the west coast of Africa? It's pure trade. What China is focusing on is securing their trade routes. That's what they want their Navy to do. That's what they want. They are deathly concerned, again, about somebody interdicting the Indians, somebody, you know, Australia with nuclear submarines cutting off their trade in the Indian Ocean. That's what they worry about.
The Indians getting pissed off about the Himalayas again and actually going, right, then we are going to broaden this war. Our Navy's going to sit in the Indian Ocean and block your trade going through.
Because China knows they lose a great power nose to nose conflict because their imports and exports get cut off. Their imports are the key thing. China cannot sustain itself. It needs those imports coming in. It needs the ore. Yeah. It needs the coal. It needs the fuel coming in.
If you want to see an interesting river running, we talk about the Belt and Road initiatives, etc. If you want to see a true belt going through the ocean, you scan up above the Indian Ocean and you watch the chain of tankers.
Yep.
On their running lights at night, going from the Gulf to China. It's a never-ending stream.
It's the same thing with ore carriers out of Western Australia going that way when they were flowing. And then, you know, out of Brazil and Argentina, it's what you see. And that's the thing that drives the Chinese crazy. And I think that's what the U.S. There was a huge debate here in the U.S. I mean, Bob Work, former Secretary of Defense, wrote a piece saying that the Navy is too focused on forward deployment, that they need to focus back on infrastructure and readiness. And he got lambasted by the U.S. Navy. Let me be clear. I mean, the Navy just jumped all over him for that, saying, oh, you're against deployment. You want to pull the Navy back, you know, and what Work was talking about is we cannot continue to sustain one third of the fleet forward deployed all the time, because if you do, you get the ships that you look at on the videos and the tweets all the time rolling in looking like a rust bucket.
Well, because it's that phrase which I come up with quite a lot, but actually I can't claim credit for it. It belongs to an admiral from the 1920s called Dreyer, who also came up with fighting tables, various things. But in the 1920s, he said in a Institute of Naval Architects in during the transactions, he said, you go to war with the fleet you have. You fight battles with the fleet you have available. You don't, nicest way, you don't, and the point is, what you dream of having, i.e. your 500 ship Navy, wonderful. Can you build that? No, well, that's not going to be the fleet you're going to have available. And by the way, the fleet you have is the fleet you have actually, that's actually floating at the moment, that's not being built, that's not in refit, that's not doing anything. And you fight with what is available, i.e. what is actually in the location you're fighting the battle. So there is no point in Dreyer's argument that there was no point that you should have a fixed plan of operations and you should have a fixed plan of battle, because you need to have a concept of operations, but You have no idea what actual units you're going to have available when you need to fight a battle. So if you have anything more, it's not going to work for you. I'm sorry, but my speakers have just gone.
No, we're all just...
So it's basically, it's a case of you can't do this if you don't have the things you need. You don't. You just can't do it that way.
Yep. And where are we at? So getting Carry back on. To the infrastructure build I'm here. Finished. Getting back to the infrastructure build here, you were talking about the new ships that you're building. Sal, how many are they building? Is it enough?
Well, I mean, that's the question. I mean, they're talking about replacing 15 oilers with 20. That's what they'd like. Now, whether they build that or not, we don't know. Six of them have been authorized, so we haven't gone any further than the six.
It's like the French. They're talking about building four, but, you know, by the time the next ones will be so far away that, you know, who knows what's going to happen.
But I go back to the issue, is it the right mix? I mean, do you need 20 fast oilers to do that without the right mix of vessels to back them up? You know, and that's the question. You know, again, the Navy focuses on what do I need to directly support the fleet, but they're missing that component, you know, that gets the fuel to Ulithi, to Majuro, you know, all that little infrastructure element there that you need to keep it going. And they don't want to talk about that because they keep thinking, well, you know, it doesn't matter because global commerce is safe. We don't need to worry. We can always charter vessels.
That's someone else's problem.
Right. Until someone else goes, actually, I'm going to interdict all this global commerce.
Well, you see, the thing is, to interdict that global commerce is quite easy. This is the point people have to make about Chinese submarines. They're always telling me, oh, they're so noisy, it's going to be easy in a war to try and hunt them down. They're just noisy. And I go, yes, if they're coming after your carrier battle group, what happens if that submarine, instead of going after your well-defended carrier battle group with its anti-submarine warfare helicopters and its frigates and all that, just decides to go, I don't know, sit at the Stratus trade lane and take pot shots at merchant ships going past? How are you going to protect it? Do you have enough of those escorts to defend those? Do you?
But it goes back to the idea of, are these commercial vessels, which are no longer national fleets, now they're, you know, international corporations through open registries, are they going to make themselves available to you? You know, are they going to take that risk? Goes back to the insurance issue.
This is Australia's problem, isn't it? You know, this is the thing about, you know, Australia hasn't got a single merchant ship under its own flag. And all it's going to take is someone like, well, anyone to shake a spear at us. And all of a sudden, the insurance rates are going to go through the roof, and we're just not going to get that next fuel delivery.
Well, and then you know, I keep going that the attack, if they're made against merchant ships, isn't going to be, you know, conventional, it'll be asymmetric. You know, I go back to what happened to Maersk Lines in 2017 when they got hit by a virus, basically, Napietia, which was an offshoot of the Ukraine-Russia conflict, but it wasn't directed at Maersk. Maersk just were collateral damage. And Maersk, the largest shipping firm at the time, took a hit where every computer they had, every server they had, was infected by this virus, except for one in Lagos, Nigeria, that happened to be down because of a blackout in Lagos. And their entire network was down for over a week. And it shut down one of the largest shipping lines in the world. And again, most people didn't notice that because there were excess shipping capacity. If that happened today, it would be catastrophic. Let's be clear. There's no capacity left for vessels right now. But what happens when Russia and Ukraine intentionally target a shipping line for that style of attack? You know, an incessant cyber attack that floods their email, shuts down their servers so that they can't move vessels. I think that's the catastrophic scenario right there. What happens to oil terminals? What happens to oil tankers? It, you know, or something even simpler, Australia needs to move cargo. We needs to move, you know, troops. Well, we need to charter a vessel. Well, what stops the enemy from chartering every available vessel and just paying them not to do anything? Mm-hmm. You know, what to me, that, you know, does that not effectively shut down trade in some ways?
It's not even a new tactic. I mean, the British pulled this off in World War I and World War II, and actually even in the Napoleonic Wars against people, but especially in the First World War, to shut down German raiders. If they knew a German raider was anywhere near a certain port, they'd just buy up all the coal. And in World War II, they did the same with most of the oil on the basis, yeah, we're never going to use it. I mean, we might use it in a few years' time, but if we have it, then they don't. And yeah, I mean, let's face it, if you're I'm just thinking of like in terms of the convoys, you know, setting convoys up, even for a moment, putting aside the fact, as Sal pointed out, there's a whole other dimension now, the cyber dimension of attacking merchant shipping, even in just terms of the pure physical elements of it. When they put together convoys, for the most part in World War I and World War II, the convoys were British and later American flagged vessels, which meant they had certain obligations. They had to, you know, the governments in question could get a certain amount of leverage over them, as opposed to nowadays when almost everything is foreign flagged, and they've got a lot more capability to turn around and tell the US or the UK or whatever to just now go away. We're not actually working with you. But even then, you look at there was an economic impact because ships weren't sailing as needed. They were sailing when the convoy schedule dictated. Now you had to live with that because otherwise if the U-boat sunk everything, it was an even bigger economic impact, but it was still an economic impact, but it was a hit that everybody took because it's wartime. Whereas these days, if, you know, even if the hit is percentage wise the same as in terms of total amount of money and total amount of disruption, because there's so much more material goods being traded, that impact is going to be considerably larger. Assuming that you can get the merchant ships even to agree to form a convoy to trade with you, because this is
the thing. Anyone who's starting to think Iceland is going to become the model for World War II, i.e. the only way you're going to get the merchant ships, if you're America, Britain, etc., all these things, and you need those things, is to put your troops aboard the ships. Either buy them, we're using somehow the government buys the ships, or just seize them.
But then where are you going to get the crew?
That's what I keep telling the Navy. That the Navy keeps coming back to me that they're going to use the Rite of Angeri, this medieval rite that we used in World War One to seize the Dutch merchant marine. And we'll just seize every vessel in port in the U.S. port and you know, slap civilian crews on. It's like, it's great. Where
are the crews going?
you're running old crews now.
He's got some experience. After all, he's been doing naval history for a while, and he's a well-respected reporter and all these things. So he's going to be captain of the Australian merchant marine ship. Actually, considering his experience, he's probably going to be convoy commodore. Me and Drac, goodness knows what we'll be doing. We'll probably actually be conscripted into the regular Royal Navy. Probably at some point find ourselves running ships because that's got short of
power. I'll just get an ultra large, one of the ultra large liquid gas carriers, fit a gigantic 3D printed Roman trireme ram bow on it, cover it in white polythene and pretend to be an iceberg for a bit until I'm close enough to an enemy port. Then I just sail into the enemy port after having dropped the disguise and dare them to shoot at me, considering I'm sitting on a 20 kiloton equivalent bomb.
In the meantime, the modern version of a fire ship.
Yeah, on a grand scale. But I mean, this is the thing, is apart from where you're going to get the sailors, I think it comes back into what you were saying, Sal, about the cyber element. If these ships belong to a completely foreign company, that, you know, we know for a fact that you can lock out the controls of a lot of these ships. Most of that feature was brought in remotely because of the threat of pirates off the east coast of Africa. So even if you can physically go aboard with troops with guns and say, we're taking this ship, what's to stop somebody half a planet away just going, shut down, you're not having our ship? And then what are you going to do? You're going to have to spend millions of dollars and months of time trying to break some heavy-duty commercial-grade encryption, which will probably end up blanking the operating system anyway.
I mean, what did the Germans do in World War One? I mean, they had 20 passenger liners, 108 vessels in U.S. ports, 20 passenger liners, and they sabotaged them. They broke the piston rings. They, you know, because they figured it's like they didn't sink the vessels because they wanted the vessels back at the end of the war. So they did enough damage. They figured this would be take them out of service for a year and a half to two. They just didn't figure that the Americans could electric weld and fix these things as quick as they had, because, hey, wait a minute, they had a robust maritime infrastructure where they were doing a lot of repairs and everything. They could fix the vessels, and they built them.
The amount of vessels Russia orders from Germany before World War One, I sit there and go, why weren't you just ordering them from America? Let's be honest, in the 1910s and 1900s, Russia and America were fairly good terms. Russia had sold Alaska to them. They were, you know, that's the perfect place to go and buy your stuff. If you're buying it from Germany, they're good. You know, Britain and Germany are two powers who you occasionally almost fight wars with and who are your number one threats. Now don't Russia buy from America.
Russia will get them from Korea now, so it's all good. And on available crews, let's be clear. We have a huge database of people who play World of Warships that we can tap into at any moment right there and use until the U.S. Navy realizes that's a Russian platform. It's controlled by the Russians.
You can't come onto a merchant ship, but instead of a steering wheel, there's just four giant WAS and D keys. Someone's just standing there for a two-week voyage across the Atlantic with a finger pressed on the W. the thing is what you were saying earlier, Sal, about like chartering the ships, it's a perfectly valid point, because if you're a third party ship owner and there's a war going on and one side is saying we want your ships, we may take them by force, however we get our hands on them, we're going to send them out into dangerous conflict zones where they might get sunk and you're going to lose that asset, and we're probably not going to pay you back for it, and if at all, at least until the end of the war, if at all, and the other side is just the insurance rate will be through the roof, and the other side is saying, well, we'll pay you a lot more money for your ship to just swing idle in a European or African or Asian port, which one are you going to take? You know, if somebody says, oh yes, well, Dan, we'd like to charter your ship to take some cargo to America, and you're sitting there going, yeah, but I was offered double the money to sit here in port, and if it goes to America, I'm probably never going to see that ship again. The ship's just not going to move.
And that's the Ukraine scenario. I'm sorry, but you know, I've looked at this in trying to figure out how the U.S. is going to, you know, should Russia and Ukraine go at it? You know, how does the U.S. handle that situation? And again, you know, you can sit there and tell.
Just going to get breaking news at the moment. The enclave insurgents are claiming that they are resisting a Ukrainian push to break into Russian territory. So it looks like Ukraine is invading Russia even as we speak. Yeah.
Well, the
Ukrainians. Yeah, I'll believe that in a.
I don't know. Some.
It's just like those Poles in 1939 invading Germany. Exactly. I knew it.
I mean, the thing is, on the one hand, yes, it could very well be a false flag. On the other hand, to be honest, I don't think the Ukrainian. I would say there's not really so much a Ukrainian army on the front as there is a series of rather interesting military formations which take varying levels of control from Kiev, some of whom happen to be the Ukrainian army. So
it's possible.
Yeah, I mean, if one or two, because I mean, we've known from reports over the past few weeks that both sides have been flinging explosives at each other over the border. So somebody snapping and just going, stuff it, we're going to go and ferret out those artillery pieces is entirely possible. And given the rather flexible loyalties of that entire region anyway, you know, it could be anything. It could be one commander's gone, stuff it, I've had enough of being shot at without replying, people are making a big deal out of it. It could be a complete false flag attack. It could be something really complex, like, I don't know, the KGB went in and replaced all the officers in a battalion and gave them false orders. Because, I mean, what better way to do a false flag than with an actual Ukrainian unit?
Yes.
Yeah.
But anyway, back to the shipping.
Yeah, the Olympics are finished.
The only thing I'm going to say about
it is, remember, you have to remember also with Ukraine, it has three seasons: winter, when the ground is frozen; mud; summer, when the ground is baked; and then mud too. So basically, they're trying to get in before mud begins, because let's be honest, once mud begins, you ain't going to get your tanks going anywhere. Yeah. This is one of the joys of the Eastern Front, is people always go, oh, it was the winters which were so hard, or oh, this stuff. No. It's the spring and the autumn when it's mud to get through that area.
Yeah, on the other hand, though, that was mostly a German problem. The T-34s didn't really have too many issues with the mud comparatively. So counting the Russians out just because it's slightly muddy is not something I would safely say is a...
Well, no, I'd say
Soviets also built highways too. There's highways now, which is something else too. We don't have to go across.
But you haven't, as much. Haven't bypassed the Dardanelles yet, and I can assure you that Australia is not volunteering to go back.
Listen, we're going to go. Luckily, 2.0 is in the plan. I'm telling you right now.
And they need to go to take the Dardanelles now. We need to send the light horse.
See, the concern I have here is that your current prime minister does see himself as a bit of another Churchill.
Well, he's got the drinking part down.
He does.
Yes.
I'm telling you, Mel Gibson's ready. Mel Gibson is ready to go for Gallipoli 2.0,
which is like the other guy. So we'll leave that to one side.
We just have to set free the toupee that's been forcibly chained to his head for the past few years, and he'll have the baldness as well.
What do we do about
as someone who's been a lot closer to that hair than, frankly, any than he'd really like to? It's sadly, it's not a toupee. It is his real hair. It's quite scary.
Matters Oceanic. Can we block the Dardanelles by sinking the Queen Elizabeth there?
No.
It's full of gel anyway at the moment. The Sea of Marmara is just a horrible load of snotty industrial effluent. So,
yeah.
To be honest, I doubt, given the density of it, you could probably sink anything there anyway, or just settle a few feet and wander off.
Drop a match.
Yeah, that might work. Set it on fire. Wild.
Finally find out what was the cause of Greek fire.
So basically, you know, this is why there's currently no real Western naval presence in the Black Sea, I'm guessing.
Well, the Montreux Convention. I mean, Montreux keeps everybody out. And, you know, I had somebody ask me the other day about it. And first off, the amount of lack of knowledge on the U.S. side about this is fascinating. Why, you know, why don't we just plant ships in the Black Sea and leave them there? Well, you can't. I mean, it's illegal. You can't do it.
Are you going to support them?
Yeah, I mean, you really want to put an aircraft carrier in the Black Sea? I mean, that makes no sense whatsoever. But like you said, I mean, how do you support Ukraine should a conflict happen? Do you really want to force yourself through the Dardanelles and the Bosphorus, even if the Turks let you through? Is that a smart maneuver to do? And that's the biggest problem, too, is what NATO allies are going to be the supportive ones? Not the Germans, it sounds like. It sounds like Germany's out for that. Mm-hmm. So you got to go into the Baltic? Well, that's you know, how many times have navies gone to the Baltic and that been successful?
No, the only option I can really see for navies in terms of trying to deter or influence Russia is if they're suddenly the Royal Navy, the French Navy and the US Navy decide to start playing with aircraft carriers off the north coast of Norway for an exercise or something like that. That might, because it's basically, it's the case of, well, yes, you're fighting down there and you've concentrated all your forces down there. No, you don't want to start playing around the Mediterranean with those three. Because a nice way to Mediterranean, you want to be somewhere where it's going to sound strange. Mediterranean is a long way from Moscow. Whereas if you're up in the White Sea, let's say, you are not such a long way from Moscow.
Okay. Can I just say that the U.S. is conducting an exercise in Norway right now? I mean, there's a marine prepositioning vessel out of Diego Garcia up in Norway. The Marines have a whole brigade stored up there in prepositioning left over from the Cold War that they keep up there. We've just activated a vessel from the East Coast. It's over there. So, I mean, they're doing an exercise up there. So it's not getting a lot of attention. I think it should, because it gets the Russian attention right away that there's Marine units sitting up in Norway. You know, Norway, again, one of the original NATO members that shared a border, the only one that shared a border with the Soviet Union besides Turkey. So, I think we're doing a lot to kind of do this. My issue going back with Ukraine is Sealip's side is we're not doing that much, but I mean, we haven't seen anything move through the Suez. So none of the big prepositioning ships out of Diego Garcia and Western Pacific have moved yet. At least they're not showing up. They will show up as soon as they get to the Suez. They have to turn on their transponders and then we'll know they're there. But, you know, you haven't seen that big movement. But if they start activating ships on the East Coast of the United States and they start talking about moving things again, I just don't. Where do you go into Salonika in Greece? In Dubrovnik, you know, in former Yugoslavia, you know, you need a lot of host nation support to get there to start providing that key logistics.
Those are still a long way away from Ukraine. This is the point. Yeah. I keep trying to make people go, well, we're going to get Ukraine. We can fly there. You can't fly much. You really can't. You want to say, you know,
and well, and once the war, once to really honest, once if dash when a war actually kicks off, you try and fly in airlift stuff, the Russians just poke them out of the sky because why not? Yeah. And if you're driving it, it's well, A, I'd love to see like Greece and Hungary and Romania, etc., closing large sections of the highway to support an armored division being trucked up there, but also it's very freaking obvious. You can't hide that. So again, you'll have a bunch of Iskanders or something just pointed at where that road crosses into the Ukrainian border. And like, oh, right. Okay. Well, here they go. Gone. This is why you do the sea lift and the build up before the shooting starts.
And they haven't yet.
If you're going to do it when the shooting starts, you do it. You land very close and in tactical formations, not on the lorries.
Which comes back to the problem of where are you going to conduct an amphibious assault operation in the Black Sea, which is almost it's the very definition of in naval terms of fish in a barrel these days. You could do it in the Crimean War when there wasn't an air threat, but
again, the Marines are going to have their light amphibious warship, and they'll be good to go because we're going to be able to land 75 Marines at a time at $100 million.
Please don't sell. There are people in the UK who actually think a company landing group is a sensible idea.
Well, the Navy thinks 14 knots is zipping around too. Can I be clear? They say that in their official reports because that's fast, obviously.
Look, you know what you can do here is if you've got these ships, surely you can support them by putting fuel bladders and LCSs. They can be the underway replenishment ships.
That's good because you know aluminum is not dangerous enough. Let's add fuel oil in there and just turning it into floating. But then now we're back to Drax explosive LNG carrier
fire ships.
Fire ships. We found a use for them.
Oh yes,
we have finally found a use for them.
They've even got a pointy end.
And just to be clear, the U.S. Navy fire ships are usually large deck amphibs. It's usually not. It's a terrible joke. I apologize.
I suppose you could play a real double bluff on the Chinese, paint the hulls blue, put some fishing nets down the side, move in a large swarm at 10 to 12 knots around the world, and set all your AIS transponders to some undecipherable Mandarin gibberish. No one, as has been seen, no one will mess with the Chinese fishing boat swarm. And by the time people have questioned why the Chinese are out fishing in the middle of the Black Sea, you've landed a few dozen Marines somewhere and you could run away again.
Okay, so time, guys. Wrapping up arguments? We need some wrapping up points.
I'm crying, so someone else go first.
I think that the point is, you know, I know it's something of a trite saying, but a lot of the time when you look at battles or even entire wars and campaigns in the middle, quite often when you look at the infrastructure and logistics side of things, you can often tell that the entire thing was won before the first shot was fired, simply by the fact that one side had the ability to outlast the other, regardless of anything that happened tactically.
Japan is a classic example of this.
Yeah, exactly. Mm-hmm. I mean, there's almost every single major war that's been fought. When you go back and see who won, who lost, the people who lost were almost always the ones with the poor infrastructure. The only time that anyone's won a war with a relatively poor infrastructure has either been way back in ancient times where you just ate everything that was around you and moved on to the next area. And even then that didn't usually work out too well. Or in the case where it was completely overwhelming firepower being directed against somebody who had basically no ability to resist on the scale of, you know, the British Empire versus Zanzibar. That lasted 30 minutes. So they didn't quite run out of supplies. But any kind of protracted campaign between either peer opponents or even people you could even begin to classify as within a power level or two of you, the people with the better logistics and infrastructure are the people who've come out the winners. If you're going to end up fighting another major conflict, whether it be with Russia over Ukraine or with China over Taiwan or with China over anything else, you need to have that infrastructure in place in the first place to keep your ships out there, to repair your ships when they come back, and to build replacements for the ships you're inevitably going to lose. And frankly, if you think any of those things aren't going to happen, you're deluding yourself.
Sal, do we need a new Liberty ship program?
Well, I go back to that presentation I did for the Navy Expeditionary Warfare Conference, and I had a slide up there that showed all the major U.S. combatants at the Guadalcanal campaign, U.S. and Australian, as a matter of fact, and so everything above a cruiser. And if you look at the attrition in that battle, it was amazing. I mean, just literally every ship was either sunk or damaged in some way. But what was really interesting to me about it was the damaged vessels were repaired within short periods of time, and even the sunk vessels were replaced by new builds. I mean, literally within the time of the war. I mean, you lose the Northampton, you build the Northampton. Canberra goes down, we build one. We replace them. And it was really amazing that we were able to roll that in. If you do the same slide for the Japanese, every Japanese ship sunk is not replaced. None of them are replaced, actually. And even the damaged vessels are out for a much longer period of time. And it's not just lack of infrastructure, it was lack of resources, too. I mean, just didn't have the steel. They didn't have a lot of the material they needed to do this. And so when you talk about a new Liberty ship program, I don't think we need Liberty ship was an emergency program. I think we need to go back to the fundamentals of a building program where we're building some ships. The U.S. last year did not build one large commercial vessel, not one. There was one launched on the Great Lakes, but there was not one commercial vessel deep draft that was built in the United States. Meanwhile, China builds 40% of the world's commercial vessels, and then Japan and Korea, make up the other 93% of the top level right there. And I think when Walker writes that issue, the Navy's primary purpose is to sustain friendly commerce by sea and questions whether or not that's the mission, he misses the point, I think, that relationship between the commercial and the military side is essential. People read Mahan and they sit there and say the reason Britain was great was because of the Royal Navy. They miss the point. It's great because of the British Merchant Marine, which was protected by the Royal Navy. That's what made them great. It was this big, huge oceanic trade and empire that moved all the resources and allowed them to sustain themselves. They missed that one little part. And I think
that wonderful phrase that China likes so much, the military-civil fusion.
Yeah. But it was so important for them because they can transition over. The Royal Navy didn't worry about building purpose-built auxiliaries because they had the Royal Navy. They had the Merchant Marine to tap into, the Merchant Navy they could tap into and use. And the U.S. had that for a long time. But, I go back to the fact that after World War II, we bifurcated. We don't acknowledge the role of the Merchant Marine. It's secondary to the success of World War II. And now, because of Panama, Liberia, Marshall Islands, we think, we don't need it anymore because our trade is handled by these seemingly anonymous entities that will always be there in case we need it. And so I think as long as we operate in this delusional state that everything's good, everything's fine, there will always be commercial vessels available, then the U.S. is doomed. The reason China does not have a merchant marine that it's 100% dependent on. I think it's maybe about 15-18% of their trade, but they have that core component there. Should something happen, they can rely on, and it can support them. Right. And so, here the U.S. sits at 21st in the world in size of its merchant marine. The British at 22nd. Australia is nowhere to be seen on the top 35. I think they just completely miss it because, again, what do you get? What were the three things we were going to talk about? We were going to talk about dry docks and infrastructure. Well, if you're not repairing commercial ships, you don't need dry docks and infrastructure for what the Navy provides.
Dry docks and infrastructure, nice way. The limitation on our carriers at the moment, we're sitting there going, we've really got one dry dock, graving dock, which we can use. And we really need to invest in more and upgrade the ones we have. And the sizing limitations on our carriers was because of the size of the graving docks. Could have gone for a bigger carrier. We could have probably afforded a bigger carrier for not much more, or probably about the same money as we ended up spending. But we couldn't build it because we didn't have the graving docks for it.
We can't send the Ford into the Pacific because there's no dry dock for it. The only dry dock that fits the Ford is in Norfolk, Virginia. That's it. The Puget Sound one doesn't fit it. So, you're stuck with Ford in the Atlantic right now until you fix that dry dock. And you know, so right
and you
there,
need but, more than one dry dock, because if it gets damaged, you need to be able to draw it to the dry dock.
It's those kind of fundamentals right there that get missed. So, I mean, we're talking about dry docks and repair facilities. Again, just go back to McCain and Fitzgerald and how long it took to fix those two vessels. You know, it was less time to build a new Burke than it was to fix Fitzgerald in Pascagoula. Then, and McCain went to Japan, and even in Japan, they didn't fix it fast enough in Yokosuka. It took that long. And then, you know, again, commercial fleet. Where's that commercial fleet? Again, I go back to the issue of sea lift. You know, the U.S. Reserve sea lift fleet is 45 years old. I mean, we just send a ship out on a test activation. It's 50 years old, you know, and you know, I joked about the other day, I posted that tweet about those two passenger ships from Crystal Cruises and buying them. And I had everyone come back at me. No, the Navy will build it. It's like, no, we're running command ships and tenders and hospital ships that are 50 years old, and they're never going to allocate money to replace those things. Never. Because all that money is going to go to things that shoot bang, bang. You know, that's what the Navy focuses on.
Yeah. F-35s, it might not.
They float really well. I don't know if anyone has really noticed how well that F-35 floated, but it was phenomenal how good that thing stayed afloat.
How high out of the water it was, yeah.
Saunders Row would like to know where their patents have disappeared. just backing up something Sal mentioned, you know, earlier about, you know, people who plan for a war saying, oh, it's going to be a short war, it'll be fine. Yeah. May I point out the last time the US faced a major conflict where it had a bunch of carriers it had to use, i.e. World War II, you had 8 carriers to start with, if you count Langley and Ranger. By the end of 1942, there were 3 of them left. So well over 50% losses.
Two of which were out of action.
Yeah, and one of which was Ranger, which nobody wanted to put on the front lines in the first place. So technically two out of seven rather than 3 out of 8. And if you'd also gone to the extent, as Sal was mentioning, of people saying, oh, we're not going to need to repair them either, well, Saratoga would have been out of action by a third of the way into 1942, and Enterprise would have been out of action by maybe about a third of the way into the Guadalcanal campaign. So with the kind of attitude of we're not going to need to replace and we're not going to need to repair and we're not going to worry about any of that, if the US had gone into World War II with that same attitude, they would have been completely out of fleet carriers by September, October 1942.
And the worst thing about that,
please note, the Royal Navy would probably have still have might not have actually supplied Victorious to be USS Robin under those circumstances, because why would they want to give them something which they would have been
it would have been the only carrier in the Pacific at that point on the Allied side. And you know, and more to the point, the fact is that's not a very long time. The US carriers, they went on some initial raiding offenses and stuff, but they didn't get properly stuck into fighting the Japanese until Coral Sea. So you're looking at maybe 6 months to go from notionally 8 carriers to none under that kind of paradigm of
The other thing about this concept of not needing to repair, it sort of assumes you're only going to have one opponent. So what happens, Sal, when you're not bothering to repair your ships and the Canadians decide to move south?
Oh, they win. Let's be honest with the Canadians. Every ground war they've ever fought with the Americans, they end up winning.
Well, they do.
They do.
They do have ice strength. They do have ice strengthened bows. So, you know, my 3D printed trireme idea might not be such a terrible one.
I think we're seeing the effect. Deploying the hockey players and lacrosse players, but okay.
Well, we're seeing the effectiveness of their truckers. I mean, so that's definitely going to play a role. No, I just don't understand the notional concept that we operate under sometimes, that we think, again, you know, hey, we're going to have a 500 ship Navy. It's like, we can't even get 300. I mean, I don't even know where how this concept comes in.
CNO said we're going to have a 1,000 ship Navy by including all the allies, and some of the maths and went, well, actually, even with allies, it only gets up to like 450.
Yeah.
But, you know, I'm sure that it's just being said because someone somewhere in politics wants to hear it said.
Well, they do. And again, you know, it's they will say whatever they need to parrot to get that funding. But again, the critical thing is, what are they going to fund? And again, my issue is they're going to fund a couple of key programs. They'll fund the carriers. They'll fund the ballistic missile submarines. They're going to fund the frigate program because they have to now. But, you know, they keep saying they're going to build 50 of them. But again, we're not going to see a frigate until 2030 at the earliest. And even then, I don't bank on that because we're still waiting for Ford to come out. We're still waiting for LCS modules to ever show up, you know, which are not going to show up. It's sad. It really is. And I go back to, why does the U.S. Navy in such a poor shipbuilding situation? And I argue because we got rid of commercial shipbuilding. It's that simple. If you don't build ships, then what you wind up building are works of art. They're individual pieces of art, and they take a long time to build and get operating and get running. And, you know, we're kind of pumping out Burks really well, but, you know, that design's at its limits. You can't go any further. I agree. The Zumwalt is the hull and design you have. It offers a lot of utility. It's power through the roof. It's got great options, but they don't want to build those. They really don't, because they're building Burks. They know they work. They just don't want another program to start over again and build. And it just goes to that issue. Again, that talk I gave, are we the Americans in early 1942, or are we the Japanese if we get into a conflict? I think we're the Japanese. I think that's where we're at. We're going to fight with the Navy we have. There's going to be no major reinforcement for it, except maybe a few vessels. And as we lose vessels, that's it. We're not replacing them. Whereas China's pumping out 19, 20 combatants a year. I mean, how many Type 55, 52s can they pump out on a fairly consistent basis? And that's in peacetime, by the way, let alone a wartime environment where they shift over their commercial yards to full wartime production and really start pumping them out. You know, and that's the scary scenario for me.
Yeah, and I mean, this was the thing, it, again, has historical precedent all the way back. You know, as I pointed out, with the Anglo-Dutch Wars, the British could keep coming back and rebuilding their fleet no matter how many times the Dutch took large chunks of it away. And even in the Napoleonic Wars, although it eventually didn't win them the war, part of what made it such a protracted event was that the Royal Navy had to spend basically the entire war doing coastal blockades, because for every Cape St. Vincent, every Nile and every Trafalgar that was fought, the French just kept building more ships. So you kept having to take them away again. And obviously
which was useful. It did help the Royal Navy.
It didn't work out for the French in that particular case, but it's kind of an isolated example of, and to be honest, it's also because the Royal Navy could build even more ships than the French could. So
yes,
And you can impress 8,000 American seamen to man your ships. So, you know, maybe we need to start thinking about impressing. We can go out there and grab some Panamanian crews and Liberian crews and start taking them over.
Puerto Rico suddenly gets fast tracked to statehood. I mean, how many territories are there out there still all suddenly get awarded statehood, and then 2 minutes later the draft is back?
If we bring back in the Philippines, we're good to go. I mean, let's be clear. They have the largest seafaring population out there. Our biggest mistake was obviously giving them their independence. That could have been our asset there to keep them.
Oh, dear. I honestly, I know Jamie's going to expect me to do some summing up, and my summing up is I'm depressed. But no, it's the whole scenario I keep looking at, and I keep thinking on a kind of this long-term thinking, and that's the trouble. I'm not sure if we ever had it, but there certainly seems to be in periods of when it was more apparent than now. You know, if I look back at the Royal Navy and the British government, it would every 6 years pretty much go through their infrastructure and go, we have to expand our graving docks, we have to look at this around the empire, not just in the UK, around the world. They would, and you sit there and look at that and go, look at the infrastructure around the world. And huge amounts of it is still based on the last cycle of that, which was done in the 1930s by the British, not just in the UK, but around the world.
London's still mostly running on Victorian infrastructure. Everything we've built since then just breaks.
It's just, you sit there and you just go, what happened? No, what was the was it the legacy of the World War? So they just sap everyone of their ability to think long term. You know, what happened? Was it the Cold War when everyone decided that wars will be over in 45 minutes, so there's no point bothering?
To be honest, I actually genuinely have a theory on that, and it's the theory I've been working on for quite a few years, which and it is actually a very depressing theory. And I actually think that for the vast
that's what we need. We need there's something more depressing this morning.
Yeah, no,
we haven't been depressed enough by this.
It's actually the reason why I the more I've thought about it, the more and more I hate the First World War. Is that I personally think a lot of the problems we have these days can be traced back to the First World War. Because when you compare it, I mean, the Second World War did have a lot of casualties, to be fair. But the Second World War was very much more an industrial war of entire nations against other nations. The First World War was also an industrial war, but it started off like a classical war. And that meant, you know, you had, yes, Germany had a conscript army as well as it had a large army, but a lot of it was made up of conscription, but there was a professional core to it. But when you look at especially Britain, which is obviously where most of my knowledge resides, for the first couple of years of World War One, apart from the backbone of conscripts that form some of the continental armies, most of the fighting was done on all sides by volunteers. So you had a regular army, but in Britain, up until 1916, the army was made up entirely of volunteers. And even though France and Germany and Russia had conscription, etc., the main influx of reinforcements in those first few years was, again, volunteers. Everyone brought in full on, like, no, you're of age, you're going to the front, regardless, at some point. But those first few years, which was also the years where most of the worst of the slaughter took place, were done by people who'd volunteered to be there. The people who, you know, and if you think about it, and this is where it gets really depressing, the people who actually volunteer to go and fight on the front lines are the people, they're volunteering because most of them, they actually care about what happens to the country that they live in.
Mm.
Yeah. They are literally the best and the brightest and the ones who want there to be a future, the people who are thinking about a future, the people who are planning for a future for the most part. And then World War One goes off and basically wipes out the cream of the crop as far as most of the European nations are concerned. And given that the US, you know, took a fair few casualties as well, a good chunk of the US. So if you're then faced with going into the 20s, 30s, and into the rest of the 20th century, that hundreds of thousands, if not millions of people who are killed on the front line in the West, on the Western Front, and also on the Eastern Front, for that matter, those were the people who probably would have been the long-term thinkers, the visionaries, the people who got everything moving. I think that's why you see cultural shift before and after World War One in terms of that kind of level of thinking of actually looking out for what's in the best interest of the country and not what's in the best interest of yourself. Obviously, some people survived, but, you know, how many brilliant potential future leaders who had both the brains and the attitude to make their countries better went down in the mud on the Western Front and elsewhere?
And how many of them who survive are stigmatized by it? I mean, yeah. it's you know, I literally teach a World Civ course in an hour and 46 minutes, which we're talking about World War One, and that's the topic. I mean, it's just, you know, and the reason I chose World War One is one of three topics for that course is because I would argue that the modern world we live in is a direct result of that event. And a lot of those lessons they learned, you know, we seem to forget for some reason. We think we're so far detached from that period of time. But in truth, you know, things like infrastructure are so vital for that. You know, right now in the US, we're throwing money at the infrastructure problem. We're just literally billions of dollars. We're just throwing it at it. Just ports, for example. We're with no rhyme or reason, I can tell you that I can figure for how we're doing port development and infrastructure. We're in the midst of a supply crisis.
I want one of those.
Yeah, right. Which is, you know, a massive supply crisis. We can't move goods. And yet what we're doing is in the United States, ports are controlled by states and municipalities, not the national government. And we're literally throwing money at
issues that whoever has the best brief or idea where, okay, here's money, go do something to fix this. No national plan, no strategy at all. You know, and we're hoping by throwing money at this problem, it's going to be fixed and rectified so that 10 years from now, it's not a potential problem. And instead, the supply crisis isn't getting better. It's either staying the same or in some cases getting worse. And you know, I don't know what we do to fix this. And I think it's spilling over in our military, or the military is reflective of it. I'm not sure which one. I don't know if it's cause or effect.
It's just in time logistics and the wars of choice paradox and the end of history. All these lovely things which come out of the 1990s with the end of the Cold War, and people actually drink the Kool-Aid and believe it. And you sit there and go, no, it's not.
All right. Well, once you solve the problem, Sal, let us know.
Okay, we'll be back on next week then. I'll see you guys next week and we'll be good to go.
If you can think of a way to convince the Australian government to, you know, actually buy a few ships, that could be handy. And I'm not talking warships here. I'm talking, well, okay. Let's put the Hunter to one side, and let's put the nuclear subs to the other side. And let's just say, all right, well, we are totally dependent on Furlex imports via sea from Singapore. How do we get it here? We're going to build a pipeline. We're going to invent some sort of quantum teleportation system, or we're going to invest.
I'd love you guys to build a pipeline, because that would just make targeting it so easy.
or we're going to build ships and find ways to look after them.
Well,
in which case, you just start ramping up the Hunter procurement.
Well, I was going to say the Hunter probably isn't that either.
I go back to what you said earlier, Jamie. You talked about, you know, who's the next Henry J. Kaiser. You see it in Japan, Korea, and China right now. They're building ships that way. I mean, they're modular. They're building them. You know, those designs aren't that much different from each other. They, you know, plus them up, shrink them down. I mean, they got the designs there. It's just, you know, we need to commit to doing that in different countries. And again, I'm not talking about the U.S. becoming the major shipbuilder of all time, but I mean, they should be building something. Every nation should be building something, especially if it has a Navy, you know, for its own defense. You know, you should have some of that inherent capability. It drives me crazy. The U.S. wants to talk about being the sea power on the planet, yet it doesn't build a commercial element to sustain it. They think they can do it all military. They again missed that lesson. I think Australia is the same way. I don't think you're talking about Australia becoming a major, you know,
no,
naval power, but again, it should be building at
sustain
least.
And, yeah.
It would actually have helped. It would actually made Australia's life incredibly easier with the Hunter procurement, with the submarine procurement, all these things. If you actually did have a civilian production facility, and it's, you know, look at the Britain at the moment. If the Royal Navy wasn't building ships, there would be no ships built being constructed in the UK, barring some very specialist vessels at Camel Lairds, occasional rigs and offshore power supply systems at Harland and Wolff, and fishing boats. And this is the point.
And that's what we're seeing, is just specialized ships. Again, if you want 93% of all your commercial vessels built in Japan, China, and Korea, that's great. But just realize that those countries don't like each other. And there may be an issue.
And they're
one
very
time...
close. If anything happens, in nicest way, you're going to lose the production facilities in those countries.
Right. So this could be a serious problem here, because you see, Australia doesn't even build its own kayaks, as far as I'm aware. I think we could bring most of them from New Zealand. And you know how we get along well with them.
Oh, good Lord. The Kiwis are going to win any war with you guys, aren't they? Because they can actually build the kayaks to get to you.
Well, I think what it comes down to in the end is a saying that I actually quite like to throw out at people when they irritate me, because they just witter on about things forever and a day and never actually do anything. And it's a saying that's so old, it's in a dead language, which is facta non verba. Words, not deeds, not words. Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
And this is ultimately the thing. You can say you want to do things. You can say you're going to do things. You can say that you're top of the pile, unless and until you actually back that up by doing something that reflects all of that.
You do realize.
I tend to respond, CV passum parabellum. Those who wish for peace should prepare for war.
The irony of that, Drac, is that's the motto of the U.S. Merchant Marine Academy. So that's the.
I was going to say that the bilge pumps motto can be the opposite to that, the verba non factum.
I don't know. I'll quite happily leave my suicide trireme somewhere worthy.
You can leave your suicide trireme. I will leave the ship, which will try and get you out alive from that one.
It better be fast. I'm telling you right now.
It's not going to be a freaking LCS. I will resurrect an Avial class if I have to, will not be an LCS.
I'll just have a ballistic escape pod. Just use the entire thing as a bomb pump cannon and just fire myself into orbit.
The Italians come up with vengeance.
Hey, hang on. Our space command here in the United States is planning on logistics resupply by rocket. So
on the way past.
That's going to be very small, very high value gear, isn't it?
No.
Extortionate.
For your company level troop ships.
That's right.
No. That's not going to be company. That's going to be squad level.
Well, the world's fastest MRE ration comes pre-cooked by orbital reentry.
Oh, good Lord.
We'll just land the SpaceX right there on the LAW.
Special operations troops. We're doing space-based resupply.
They'll have to change
What's that, a meteor? No.
They'll have to change the instructions on the MRE from rock or something to rocket or something.
You'd be able to identify the American rocket because it'll have rust on it like our ships and our F-35s.
We should probably wrap it up there then.
Yeah. Thank you very much.
Yeah.
Take care.
It's been a pleasure as always, Sal.
Sorry, we're such a rabble, but you're used to us by now.
Fifth time, and we're still not talking about something positive. I'm serious.
We have to have you back and actually talk about something which doesn't leave all four of us going away mildly depressed and even more sarcastic than we normally are.
Especially on a Monday morning heading off to work.
I have to teach students after this, as the Sal.
It's all
those
over.
Poor kids are going to suffer.
Well, it's all over.
Here's a very British positive. If by the next time we reconvene, we are actually at war with Russia, we'll get to say, I told you so.
I don't want to, though. I get fed up with other people saying, you're going to tell me I told you so. And I go, I'm not, because honestly, I don't have the energy. I will just say, I spoke muscly.
Just get a t-shirt that says it.
Yeah.
All right. See you then.
See you then.
Take care.
Bye.
Bye.
Welcome to the Bilge Pumps, where a bunch of naval geeks spout off.